We reverence the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, the shower of the way. We reverence the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, which leads from darkness to light. We reverence the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples that inspires and guides. So this is my third and final talk. So what am I going to say? Well, I think I want to start by telling you about the last 2 years. Since I stopped working for Windhorse Evolution, for which I worked for 25 years, I've been working in a mental hospital, which I'm really getting a lot from, I must say, and I think I give quite a lot too. But it's interesting, I have to work shifts, and there's 3 shifts in the 24 hours. There's earlies, they start at 7 and finish at 2:30. There's lates, which start at 1 and finish at 9. And there's nights, which start at 8:30 and finish at 7:30. And I do them all the different times. And having had a very, very structured Dharma life most of my life, where I get up at a particular time, meditate at a particular time, all that was just thrown right up into the air. How do I live my life now? Anyway, I seem to manage to do it. I've been amazed. I actually really like nights, for instance. So I'm going on nights when I come off the retreat. So I actually really like them. I'll get a chance to meditate there as much as I want to. And there's lots of good things about shifts. But I've had to work out my social life. I've had to work out my sleep. I've had to work out my practice. How am I going to fit it all in? Anyway, I seem to manage to do it somehow. And there's usually a little bit of time left over for entertainment, as we say. And I've discovered a new entertainment in the last 2 years, which I've never had before. And it's called listening to audiobooks. I always thought audiobooks were for idiots that couldn't sort of read or something, or I never realised just what a great way it is to take in English literature, European literature. Also a great way to take in the Dharma. I only buy the ones, I spend about £8 a month on, I've got a deal with Amazon, and I only get the ones that are read by professional actors that can do all the different voices, and really well. It really makes quite a difference how well something's read. You know, if it's Jane Austen, you know, to have someone who can do all the different accents is very good. But definitely the best book that I listened to in 2016 by far was called The Buddha and the Sahibs by Charles Allen. The Buddha and the Sahibs. There was quite a buzz when this came out in the Buddhist world in 2002. And for some reason, I didn't pick it up. I didn't read the book, and I should have done. Anyway, I'm very, very glad to have caught up with it now. I've listened to it twice, actually, all the way through, because it's so good, because I didn't want to miss anything. And what it's all about, it's a fascinating account, really, of the British Raj, about the, you know, the British Empire in India, you know, the Great Game, as it was called, where for hundreds of years, the British and other European countries, but mainly the British, sort of went into India and possessed it and took it over and ran it and exploited it. And that went on from pretty much the 1600s, late 1500s, early 1600s, right on till, the mid-1940s when India became independent, thankfully. But it's a fascinating account of men and at least one woman who rediscovered Buddhism completely in India. A lot of Indian history was unknown throughout that period. And, we owe these men and at least one woman a great deal, I must say. We may not even be here without them at all. They were British judges, soldiers, administrators, archaeologists, orientalists, and adventurers. And mainly, the main work was done during the Georgian and the Victorian period. And these were people who were out there doing, in India, doing their jobs. But they were fascinated by Indian history, and particularly this character called Baud. There was a character called Baud, and there was some sort of faith or religion around Baud, and that's about as much as anyone knew. And they didn't even know the term Buddha at that time. They thought he was called Baud. And they systematically set about digging up and understanding Baud. Men such as William Jones, James Princep, Alexander Cosmo de Coros, Madame Blavatsky, William Pepe, Sir Edwin Arnold, Alexander Cunningham, just to name a few. If you really want to see a bit more about this, you can go on YouTube and just key in Bones of the Buddha, and you'll see a fascinating documentary on exactly what I'm talking about. But during the 18th century, there was a really big breakthrough in all this, because there was a particular Orientalist called, who was a circuit judge in Calcutta, called Sir William Jones, and he basically realised he'd understood Sanskrit. He worked out what Sanskrit was after painstaking decades of trying to understand the language, and he worked out exactly what he could read the Buddhist texts, could actually work them out. By doing that, he could understand what Buddhism really was and what it was saying, what the teachings were. This was an enormous breakthrough. Because before that, for a long time, people thought that Buddhism was actually of African origin. This is how ignorant they were. And the only reason for that was the images of the Buddha, the rupas. They noticed that he had sort of curly hair, tight curls on the head. They thought, well, that looks like a kind of Negro. And also the earlobes are quite long, and they'd got all sorts of daft ideas. They didn't really know anything, because the history of Buddhism, was actually mediated at that time by Hinduism and Islam. And they'd systematically eradicated Buddhism from India. So nothing was really known. So over the centuries, they pieced together the texts, the history, the archaeology, the rupas and stupas. They rediscovered them. And they contrasted that with what was still around in Buddhism in Burma, Thailand, China, all these other countries where Buddhism was still being practiced to some extent. And there was an incredible discovery in 1898. Professor William Pepe made this incredible discovery. There's a big stupa called Pipwara, I think I've pronounced that right, Pipwara, that's it, near Lumbini in Nepal. And he kind of mined, he dug up the stupa, went right down inside the stupa, and eventually discovered this enormous stone chest, which had four reliquary sort of stupas inside it, like little vessels, containers, which were all sealed. And one of them said on the outside, these are the bones of the Buddha. And the world's greatest authority, leading authority, Professor Harry Falg of Calcutta University, says that they really are the bones of the Buddha. As far as he knows, he thinks they really are. And that this stone chest was placed in this stupa 150 years after the death of the Buddha by Ashoka. Ashoka, that's his theory. But we'll never really know that they really are the bones of the Buddha. We'll never really know. We can't know. But it's all very exciting stuff. Because Buddhism could have been really forgotten in the land of its birth. That could have really happened. And a lot of what we've got today comes from those discoveries, the kind of Dharma life that we experience. A lot of that. Perhaps it would have been rediscovered in another way later. Who knows what would have happened? It might have just all been very, very different. But I find all this really fascinating. And I think one of the things, when I look back, I look at these great people and what they did, the work that they did, the thing that strikes me is what incredible imaginations they had. They really, really had to think and imagine and put their minds to how the Buddha would have lived, what the scriptures were really saying, what the evidence was. For instance, they spent a lot of time translating Huangshan and his pilgrimage around India to the holy sites. And they found that he got a lot of his geography a bit wrong, actually, and set them off on false paths. So I had to really think and imagine and try and work out. I'm really impressed with the level of imagination of these British sides. There's so many negative things that you can say about British Raj. It's all been said. But for Buddhism, it was actually a good thing. You know, really good things came out of all that. These people really did try to imagine the Buddha, try to imagine the Dharma and the Sangha of the past. They read the texts. They excavated the stupas and rupas. They dug up the remains. And of course, by accident, they discovered the Ajanta caves. So I'm mentioning all this really because I want to talk about the imagination. And these people were a great example of that. But the imagination and the imaginal faculty is often cited by Sangharakshita as a crucial element to the spiritual life, and particularly in relation to Shraddha. If you're going to have faith and deepen your faith and broaden your faith in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, you need imagination. You need to use that faculty. Otherwise, what can happen is Buddhism can so easily fall into a kind of dry orthodoxy or formalism. Buddhism can get very formal and very dry. It happens. It's happened a lot throughout our history. And we don't want that to happen. We want it to be alive and full of meaning and life. Bhante and also Subhuti have written and explored a lot on the subject of imagination, from the English romantic poets, the glory of the literary world, right through to reimagining the Buddha. And they tell us that to really live the Dharma life, you need to develop this faculty. And very often when you talk about the imagination, people will often say, oh, I don't really have much of an imagination. I'm not that kind of person. I do struggle a bit with this. But you need to reflect on this, because the imagination allows us to escape from the prison of our immediate experience. Here we are, we've got our immediate experience here and now. It gives us, the imagination gives us access to higher mental states in meditation, which is an indispensable component of insight. We all have a strong imagination, actually. We may not think that we do, but we do. When you think about it, we're actually all highly skilled at imagining the objects of our desire. There are things that we want, aren't they, in life? Whether it be the conferring of great status upon you. You might think, ooh, if I had that job, if I got that promotion there, I could see myself doing really well in that, actually. I could just turn around this whole department if it was offered to me. I could do that. We're very good at imagining those sorts of things. Or sexual fantasies, you know. We're very good at it, actually. We're actually just working out exactly what we would like to do and with whom. We're very, very good. We can put ourselves right in that place. Sensory pleasures. Possessions that we want. We don't need to really look on the internet. I mean, it's interesting that we do that a lot of the time, but quite a lot of the time we work out what we want long before we've ever got that far. Holidays that we want to go on. We imagine I've got one next month in the Lake District, and I've already got it in my mind which mountain I'll be climbing, which lake I'll be rowing boats on, and all the rest of it. Very, very good. I can see it now. I can see Scafell Pike. Also, in a probably a less positive way, we are beset by anxiety and fear. We have anxieties and fears, and we easily imagine what can go wrong. Yeah, the terror, the horror that we might feel if the worst happens, the illnesses that may befall us, particularly unpleasant deaths that we might have to face. We often think and worry about these things quite a lot. whenever I go on my trips to India, my father always gets very worried about it. And he usually goes through a list of all the things that could go wrong. He keeps reminding me of the aeroplane crashing, being hijacked by some kind of air pirates, through to the train crashing, me getting really ill and dying of something terrible. I remember the last time I went on a pilgrimage, I went with Drita Karin for a month. My father rang me up and said, "Watch out for elephants." Poor old dad, he does really worry. And it's all true, but, you know, it's never happened. We don't lack imagination. We've got it, we've got it there, we can easily imagine things, but we just need to turn that more towards the Dharma life. We've got the faculty already. It's already there. We need to turn it to what deeply matters most, higher mental states. Because a lot of the time, we are caught up in the mundane. When I was writing this talk, I was quite inspired. I was thinking about all this, and I got into my flow when I was writing. And right in the middle of it all, I got gripped by carry-on luggage. I got gripped by carry-on luggage. And I had to keep breaking off and going on the internet and researching the different types of carry-on luggage that I needed to buy for my next trip. And I must tell everyone about this. It's ridiculous, actually. But that's what happens, isn't it? We get hijacked by the mundane quite a lot of the time. So the imagination opens up the boundaries of our being. Without imagination, there is only a limited experience of the world. Yeah? We're living in the confines of what chance happens to throw our way. And this is illustrated by a well-known story from the scriptures, which you might have heard of, called the well frog and the ocean frog. You know this one? Anyone know this one? The well frog and the ocean frog. So this is in the scriptures. So there's two frogs, yeah? We've got two frogs, and one of them lives in a well, a water well, and the other one lives in the ocean. And one day they meet each other, and the ocean frog tells the well frog, he said, "Look, this little well that you're in, it's not very big." And he says, "I live in the ocean, and it's a lot better than this." He says that you can see in all directions as far as you want to look. It's vast, it's huge. And the colour of the sea varies from black right through to the most beautiful blue. There are all these waves. Sometimes it's very calm, like a mirror. Sometimes it's really stormy. And that's just the half of it. There's all sorts of creatures that live in the sea and underneath the waves. And he goes on and on and on about it all. The well frog, who's never been to the ocean, he doesn't believe any of it. He says, "Nah, I don't believe it." So what you're on about. Your imagination's running away with you. So the ocean frog takes the well frog to the ocean, and of course he's really bowled over. But when he goes back to his well, his little well, which is his world, he's a bit dissatisfied, actually. He's not very happy. He finds it quite limiting. So we can see ourselves as well frogs and ocean frogs, can't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's what happens. And the Dharma can open up a huge ocean to us, which we didn't have available to us before. And it's true with the imagination. It opens up so many worlds to us. The riches of literature and of fiction. The riches of history, of myth, of symbolism and archetype. Aloka just sort of opened up and unfolded a bit of world of art and archetype. Just a little bit of his world yesterday for us for an hour and a half. But look how rich that was. He lives in that world all the time. He's good enough to provide these fantastic images for us that have come out of that whole world. The other thing the imagination opens up, and I think this is very important for Buddhists, is empathy. Yeah, empathy. It's a very Buddhist emotion. Metta bhavana. We're talking about metta bhavana here, in action. And We need to imagine the lives of people around us. We need to connect with them. You know, here's me in my little world talking to you. You're over there listening to me. We need to connect with each other. It needs to happen. And there isn't enough of it in the world. If there was, we wouldn't have the problems that we do. Not only that, not only the here and now, but also the past. We do need to imagine the past and understand it. There's so much we can learn from what we've got now, or why we've arrived at where we are. And also, what about the future? We need to be able to try and imagine the future in a positive way for ourselves, for other people, for humanity. If you switch on the news, it's often very negative, isn't it, about Brexit or immigration or kind of terrorist plots or whatever it is. It's awful sometimes. It's not really a true reflection of what's happening in the world, actually. It is happening, but it's very limited. So this opening up of empathy to other human beings is so, so important. It's the key, I think, to the use of the imagination. So here's a really good quote from the poet Shelley, which really summarizes this better than I can. And Shelley says, "The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and our identification of the beautiful which exists in thought, action or person, not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his own species must be his own." So this is Shelley. A going out to others. It's a very, very big part of Shraddha. So this is the imagination and Shraddha. I'm going to pause us a bit there and go back to the key subject of Shraddha and just make an observation, really, that in giving three talks on Shraddha, I've realised you can't possibly cover it all in three talks. I probably need five or six, really. There's so much to talk about. It's such a big subject. But I will tell you what I haven't talked about. I haven't talked to you about devotion and ritual and Shraddha and how important that is. I haven't talked to you about the place of Shraddha in the historical schools of Buddhism. That's a whole subject in itself. I haven't talked about Shraddha in the spiral path, but I have given you a bit of a drawing instead. I haven't talked about Ashraddha, which is the willful refusal to have faith. Ashraddha. I haven't talked about Shraddha and the 51 mental events. There's probably more actually than that, but I just wanted to let you know I haven't talked about these subjects, and they need to be done, and maybe that's something for you to explore in your own time. What I will talk about for the rest of the talk is practical ways that we can deepen our faith, and I've got 15 of them. Practical ways that we can deepen our faith and keep it alive. And the first one is, of course, use your imagination. Yeah, use your imagination. I had a teacher at school, like our local, I was lucky enough to have wonderful art teachers. And the most wonderful art teacher was called Colin Patterson. He was a Scot. He said, "Use your imagination, sonny." And it was really good. I needed to do that quite a lot of the time to develop as an artist. Use your imagination. You do need to keep this alive if you're going to keep your Shraddha alive. And here's a suggestion, here's a way that you can do it. There's a particularly good teaching which comes from the Buddha called the Four Right Efforts. Preventing the arising of unskillful mental states, eradicating already arisen unskillful mental states, developing as yet unarisen skillful mental states, maintaining already arisen skillful mental states. So preventing, eradicating, developing, maintaining. It's about daily life. It's about what we're about to do. Okay, I'm planning to go into Norwich on Saturday night. Okay, could there arise an unskillful mental state there? Could I end up going to watch a horror movie, which is what I tend to do? That's not going to lead into... No, that won't be good. I won't do that. So it's having the imagination to see where you're going. Or if an unskillful mental state has arisen, you need to imagine how you can get out of that, what you can do about that. And developing the unarisen skillful mental state needs imagination. You need to think, well, what do I need to do? Where am I at the moment? What will I need? Maintaining already arisen skillful mental states, that also requires imagination. When you're there, it's going really well. Well, how do you keep that maintained where it is? How do you stop it from falling away? All this requires imagination. So too does reimagining the Buddha and his qualities. Imagining yourself growing and changing. Imagining what difference Buddhism could make to the world. You know, Dr. Ambedkar and social change. He had a wonderful imagination because he could see the difference that Buddhism could make to one of the largest, most populated countries of the world. So, number one, use your imagination. Number two, keep a personal shrine. I'm quite surprised. A lot of Buddhists don't do this, really. They've got their rooms, they've got their houses, but there isn't a kind of focus, you know. A shrine's a nice thing to sit in front of and meditate in front of for a start. It's a great place to do that. But it's also a place where you can put the objects, the main objects of your devotion, of your faith, that you have faith in. You know, the rupa, there might be a particular rupa, particular incense or candles that you like. It's a place to keep your shraddha alive. You need to make something of it. You need to be regularly tending it, cleaning it, putting fresh flowers on it. I live in a community where someone's got plastic flowers on his shrine. And I said to him, that's not very good, is it? And he said, yeah, but they are impermanent. I said, yeah, but they're not beautiful. They'll last a lot longer, he said. They're ordinary. I think, no, you've got that wrong, really. Occasionally, you need to completely rearrange a shrine and build a new one because they go dead, don't they? Shrines go dead. You see them, they're there. And I think Padmaloka is actually very good at this. There's been a lot of different shrines over the years, all of them very inspiring. And sometimes you need to do that. You need to sort of change things a bit to really see them again. But have a personal shrine of your own. Find a little place. Everybody's got space for that. In this country, anyway. Also, you might want to put copies of the scriptures on your shrine. It's quite an important practice, this, as well as your Buddha rupas. There might be a particular scripture that inspires you. Well, that's the place to put it. Third way you can maintain and develop your faith is Kalyanamitrata. There's an awful lot I could say about spiritual friendship, and it's all been said. But we're talking about the value of Sangha. We're talking about the value of Sangha. So you might be getting on very well on your own as a Buddhist. You might be doing your meditation practice, reading your scriptures, doing all that. But you need Sangha. Everybody needs Sangha. There are some very inspiring individuals who are full of faith in the Sangha. And at all kind of levels of experience. And that rubs off on us. That affects us. You might think you know what your path is, and perhaps you do, but other people augment that. They bring out the best in you. They challenge you. They set you off in all sorts of different ways, and that's a really, really good thing to do. One of the things, when I ordain people, I like to thank them. I like to say, thank you for giving me the opportunity for being your preceptor, because often they feel they should thank me. But I think it's the other way around. I get so much from them, on my relationship with them, because it draws out all these qualities in me which I need to develop, and I do develop them. It's such a wonderful opportunity to do that. That's Kalyanamitrata for you. It's interesting, Alok was saying yesterday, the thing that really did it for him was listening to Sangharakshita's tape lectures. He hadn't met him. He probably didn't even know what he looked like, but he heard a tape lecture and that inspired him and convinced him. Well, that's Kalyana Mitrata. It can work not just through meeting people, it's also through their work. And if you're listening to this on Free Buddhist Audio now, then hopefully it will be inspiring for you. So you don't feel you always have to have face-to-face contact with people to actually feel the effect of Sangha. You can feel it through all sorts of mediums. For instance, my own personal example, my own preceptor is Subhuti, who I don't see from 1 year to the next, which I don't mind at all because I have so much faith in him. I don't feel I need to have personal contact with him. I like to have that if that happens. But he has such a positive influence on me through what he does and who he is. So that's number three. Number four, reflect on the qualities of the Buddha. Again, this requires imagination. The Buddha really was a truly remarkable individual who changed the course of world history. He really was. His ideas were revolutionary for the time that he was in, and they're also for the present era. They're also revolutionary for the Buddha. They're timeless. Sometimes I find I've learned about the Buddha from what people who admire, who are not Buddhists, who admire about the Buddha. I'm always very interested in what non-Buddhists think of the Buddha. And I recently watched a whole series on the history of India by Michael Wood, who's a historian. It's a very good series called The Story of India. And he does a whole episode on the Buddha and the effect of him. And he's definitely not a Buddhist. But he talks about what Ashoka learned from the Buddha. And this is the list that he gave. I thought it was really interesting. Conditionality, the courage in going against the established order, animal rights, all humans are one family, facing the reality of human life, good citizenship, and non-violence. Happiness comes from within. So that was kind of quite an interesting take on the Buddha's qualities. Not probably the ones that we would mainly focus on, but I think they're really, really important ones. That this incredible idea of non-violence, which was launched by the Buddhist practice. Oh yes, and there was one other. We don't need a god to live a righteous life. That was another thing that Ashoka took from the Buddha. So as Buddhists, well, his life and example, his teaching, the Sangha, his compassion, his wisdom, his metta, all these things are so important to us. We need to listen, reflect and meditate upon them. Number five, pilgrimage. Now this one might surprise you. It surprised me. I came across a list, one of those little Sangharakshita lists many years ago called 10 Ornaments of a Buddhist from Sangharakshita. And he talks about the usual things like meditation, Dharma study, spiritual friendship, kindly speech, simplicity of life, all the rest of it, forgiveness. And he also talks about pilgrimage. And I thought, well, why do you need to go on pilgrimage? Why is that important? After all, you know, India has got a bad health and safety record. And why do you actually need, it's expensive going over there, you have to get in an aeroplane, which, you know, messes up the environment. Why do you need to do that? But it's a traditional practice in Buddhism. And I can understand why people wouldn't want to go there. But actually, I think if you do, almost every Buddhist who does seems to say they get a huge amount out of it. In 2014, Tridhakaran and I went for a month's pilgrimage in India, along with some other order members, and it was a wonderful experience. We went to Kushinagar, Shravasti, Lumbini, Saranath, Rajgir, Shali, Budgaya, of course. We went also to Nepal and Sikkim. We also did a Bhante pilgrimage in Kalimpong and Darjeeling, It was extraordinary, really. I'll never forget it. And nothing bad happened at all, I don't think. Not really. Almost did, but didn't. It's an act of faith to go on pilgrimage, because you don't know what you're going to feel. You might not feel very much, but probably you will. Probably you will. There's something about being in that, the very place where the Buddha, you actually stand on the very place that the Buddha first taught the Dharma. Many people report insights, incredible breakthroughs of understanding, and lots of adventures that they'll never forget, and a deepening of Shraddha. Also, there's the world international, the world Buddhist community is there as well, also doing the same thing, and has a very, very strong effect upon you. However, you may not actually be able to go to India for whatever reason. You can actually do a pilgrimage in this country in different ways. There are significant Buddhist sites and places that you can go to in this country, and I've done some of that. And the Victorian and Albert Museum is one of them. It's a fabulous place for key Buddhist archetypes and artifacts. If you go to the British Museum, you can see the very world's oldest printed book, which is the Diamond Sutra. I went there and did a prostration. A lot of people looked very strangely at me, but I felt I needed to do it. A few years ago, I was living in Ipswich in Suffolk, and I found a remote farm out in the countryside where the Diamond Sutra was first translated in this country. So I went there, and there's a guy with his Massey Ferguson tractor and his overalls on and wellies and everything. He sort of found it all a bit strange, really, but I wanted to go there. I had a very strong experience. So don't rule that out. Number six, consider taking leaps of faith. It could be that you're a bit like me. Your default mode is you're a bit cautious and timid. Maybe that's continuing to serve you well. However, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Sometimes the opportunity of a lifetime must be seized during the lifetime of the opportunity. You have to take a spiritual risk. You have to come on a retreat that might scare you a little bit. You might sign up for a Karuna fundraising appeal. You might ask to be a Mitra or ask for ordination. You might offer to help out with the shrine on Dharma Day. Or you might want to decide to give up your job and work for Buddhism. There's all sorts of levels and ways that you can do it. Sometimes you just have to take that leap of faith. As I say, I did that. I told the story of one aspect of that and how it pays off. Sometimes you just have to do that. Number seven. Notice what you're attracted to. When it comes to deepening faith in the Dharma, the Dharma's often got a habit of throwing little teasers out at us all the time. It kind of winks at us every now and again. It will just offer something up to you, and if you're aware and notice that, your life can change as a result if you follow it up. This has happened to me many, many times. It could be just the colour of a bodhisattva. It could be just a gesture of one of the rupas, that a particular gesture, and you think, what's that? Why is that? I don't even like that. What is it? But you're kind of interested in it. It's hooked you in. It's got you going on a bit of a search. So you read up about it. You ask somebody. Before you know what, you're falling into a whole new world of the Dharma. So whatever it is, be open and follow it up. If you're annoyed, you're fascinated, you're intrigued, you're confused, follow it up. Follow it up. It will lead to all these riches. I've seen this happen so often, and it's happened so often to me. And incredible life-changing Dharma chapters can open up for you. It can be a vital piece of the jigsaw of your faith. But there's no guarantees. Sometimes the trail goes dry. Sometimes you follow something up and it is very interesting, and you think, well, I'm not particularly interested in the Abhidharma after all, I've realized. But you know, it could have been. And very often it is. Number 8, Dharma study. In a way, I don't need to say very much here. It's so obvious. We need to study the Dharma on a regular basis if we're going to deepen our faith. We need to deepen our knowledge and understanding of the Dharma. We must clarify our views. We must remove our doubts. I've covered all that before. But what I haven't said is we need to debate. We need to discuss. We need to probe. We need to discover. And the best way to do this is a well-led study group. So it could be a men's group. It could be a group on a retreat. It could be the Mitra study course. The Mitra study course is so good. It's so well presented. It's so well thought out. Why would you not want to do it? If you're a Mitra, why would you not want to do it? It's a fantastic course. It really is. So Dharma study deepens faith. Number 9, ritual and devotion. Again, so much I could say. I'm talking about puja. I'm talking about circumambulating, mantra chanting, offerings, all this kind of world. That non-rational world where we don't really understand what we're doing quite a lot of the time. It's a non-rational space, but it works directly on our spiritual lives. Sometimes years after. Sometimes people say to me, I went to the puja, it didn't really do very much for me, I wasn't really very engaged. And I kind of laugh and think, well, how can you say that? It isn't all about now. It isn't all about this day, this evening, this retreat, or even this year. It's about the rest of your life. These things can affect you way, way in the future in ways you cannot understand. So ritual and devotion, well, again, I need to give a series of talks on that. But we are much more, as Aloka was suggesting yesterday, we're much more than our rational minds. There's a lot more going on than we think there is. And if we're unlikely to encounter any of Bhante's teachers now because they're dead, but Bhante has got many stories about his teachers, and some of them could read people's minds. They were in touch with a different world entirely. They were living in that world in a way which we're not a lot of the time. But that world is there. And ritual and devotion speaks to that world. It's from that world. It's part of that world. The arrogance of the modern Western mind is we think that we know the world. We think we know it all. And also, finally, this ritual and devotion connects us with the Sangha, the Arya Sangha, from the past, present, and, of course, connects us to the future. So you may not be particularly enjoying a particular puja in one. That's beside the point. You're involved in a living tradition which has so much depth. Number 10, reading and reciting scriptures. Sometimes people are a bit surprised by this, but actually reading and reciting traditional texts, it's a traditional practice around developing faith. It's just a good thing to read them. Just even if you don't understand what they're about, just read. Sometimes even read them aloud. That's the main reason we have readings from scriptures in the puja. It's an opportunity to read aloud from the scriptures in the puja. And the benefits of that is they're uplifting. It reminds us of best practice. Yeah? Some of these scriptures are non-rational. And it means we enter into the non-rational world of the White Lotus Sutra or the Sutra of Golden Light. We have to use our imagination and be open. It's a very, very good discipline. In 1988, I took on to read part extracts from the Sutra of Golden Light. I think I was going to do it for a year, and I'm still doing it. So I'm still reading it every day since 1988. How many years is that? That's a lot of years, isn't it? And I've gained so much from that, just reading it, not even studying the Sutra of Golden Light, just reading it. I could easily give 10 lectures on the sutra, easily, because I've gained so much just from taking that information every day, just reading it. It's a great practice, it's a great discipline. So if there's a particular sutra that you're really, really attracted to, start reading it. Start reading it on a regular basis as a practice. Pick it up and read it. It's a great practice. Number 11, stories from the scriptures. It follows on a bit from my last point. Buddhist scriptures are full of stories. You know, what the Buddha did when this happened, what the Buddha said. But also the other scriptures as well, the tantras, Mahayana scriptures. They're full of, you know, the myth of the return journey from the White Lotus Sutra. There are so many stories, aren't there? And they've all got meanings. They've all got something to tell us about the Dharma. So they all increase our faith. So obviously they're stories from the life of the Buddha. But also there are figures on the refuge tree, like Milarepa, you know, the story of the towers, Nagarjuna, Anagarika, Dharmapala, and the Indian refuge tree, he's there. Chetul, Sangye Dorje, Buddha Gosha, Hakuin, Xuanzang. They've got very, very rich kind of lives. Many, many stories around them. And there's a very good book written by Kulananda called Teachers of Enlightenment. And it's in the bookshop, you can buy it. And it's all about the figures, the history of the figures in the refuge tree, on the refuge tree. And it's a fascinating read. It's so rich, reading about their lives and some of the events and stories and what went on in their lives. It's very, very uplifting and inspiring. My own source of inspiration around this is, and I know many, many stories about his life, is the late, great Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. My guru, he is my guru, and if I ever feel just even slightly flat or down, I just recall one of the stories from Dr. Ambedkar's life, because he was such a great Buddhist. Remarkable stories about how he lived, things that happened to him, and what he did about them, and they uplift me. They speak to my heart, and I'll never forget them. They teach me about the Dharma in a way. In a very particular way, which is of great value. But so many Tibetan Buddhist teachers, or the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, for instance, if you ever see those, the two big red scriptures, or read some of the stories in there. Wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. That really does deepen your faith. Number 12, just getting towards the end now. Notice your conditions. If you want to deepen your faith, notice your conditions. It's obvious, really. Get down to the Buddhist center when you can. Make friends in the Sangha. Go on retreat. Yeah? Look after your meditation and puja practice. Watch and evaluate your input. Yeah? Very important one with, you know, the internet being what it is. I don't want to be a killjoy about the internet. I enjoy the internet. But the opportunities for distraction with rubbish are vast. They're as big as the ocean. So you really do have to practice discrimination. You have to stop yourself in the middle of something and say, why am I looking at this now? What is this I'm doing here? What? How does it relate to my going for refuge? And very often you'll find that it doesn't. It's not particularly interesting at all. But you've just got hooked in and drawn in. And that will just rob you of your time and life. It won't help your shraddha. So one little experiment, I do this myself every now and again, is go through your browsing history on your search engine. Just have a look. You can just look and it'll tell you what you've looked at over the course of a week. And I find it a little bit shocking sometimes. I think, what did I really look at that? Cartoons of Donald Duck. You know, how did I get onto that? And kind of, but it's a bit of an eye opener for people. It's a bit of an eye opener. So with conditions, you reap what you sow. It's as simple as that. So look after your conditions if you're going to develop your faith. Number 13, I'm not really going to talk about very much at all. I'm just going to mention it. Shraddha Bhavana. We've done the practice. So we were introduced to the practice. There is a practice. There's different kinds of Shraddha Bhavana. But there is a practice where you can do a meditation practice based on developing Shraddha. So two more to go. 14, keep beginner's mind. Beginner's mind is a term coined from within Zen Buddhism. And it describes that incredible excitement and verve that one feels when you're astonished, surprised newcomer. The Dharma just seems so incredible to you when you find it. You know, as you know, I was 14. I just couldn't stop talking to my friends about the Dharma. They couldn't get what it was about at all. But I couldn't stop talking about it. I was so excited. It seemed so astonishing that it existed at all. It lifts you off your feet. Yeah. So it's hard to maintain beginner's mind because we're beginners. We usually have it when we're beginners. But Sangharakshita has encouraged us to keep beginner's mind. That is, try to keep finding your astonishment and surprise and love of the Dharma, which you first encountered when you came across it. Try to keep that alive somehow in your life. Not an easy thing to do. One of the ways that you can do that is you can go on retreat, you can build friendships, the kinds of things I've been talking about. But also, do go outside your comfort zone every now and again. Try and experiment a little bit. Say, well, I'll go on a shiatsu and Buddhism retreat and see what happens. You might just decide to sort of take a bit of an experiment, just not do something, to use a personal example, you know, I wouldn't easily do that. Perhaps I should do that. Where you go outside your normal route and look at things in a different way. Often beginner's mind will reassert itself in some way. I think another good way to to keep beginner's mind, is to give a talk on Buddhism. So whenever someone's looking for a talk to be given somewhere in some way, in some context, say, I'll do that. You'll find that suddenly your mind is focused in a way it normally never is. Just a little sort of 15-minute talk at the Buddhist Center, why am I Buddhist? You'll find that you're really alive around all that. 15th, and lastly, well, be receptive to Shraddha. Be receptive. Easy to say, isn't it? Be receptive. But it's a sort of general outlook that you can take. Well, I'm open. I'm a Buddhist. To be a Buddhist is to be open to the transcendental. What may arise? What may occur? What may happen? If you stay open, that big wind might just blow you, lift you right off your feet when you least expect it. And it does happen. Sometimes you're in the middle of your ordinary life and you encounter something. I remember a particular occasion where it happened to me. We were working in the evolution shop. It was a team meeting. We were having a team meeting and it was a bit dull, actually. There were issues in the team. This is probably around about 1996, I think. Ipswich Evolution Shop. And we didn't know what to do, so we decided to do a Tara Puja. And it was a bit dull. People weren't very engaged with it, but we were doing it. Did this Tara Puja. We just finished. The bell was ringing. And as it rang, a postman posted a letter through the letterbox of the room that we were doing the puja in. And it was a postcard with Tara on the front. And we all kind of, it was a staggering experience. Now what are the chances of that happening? But it really did happen. And we all suddenly sort of sat up and became very receptive to Tara, really, on that particular occasion. It really did happen. It was extraordinary. So, I'm going to round off this talk and this series with reading the English version of the Buddha Puja, just the short puja. In India, the short puja, threefold puja, is different. There's a different version. It's very, very beautiful, chanted in Sanskrit. I'm not going to do that, but I will read it in English. And it's very, very beautiful. And I'll read that now as an act of devotion at the end of the series. Buddha Puja. This spread of flowers, fresh-hued and fragrant, I offer at the sacred lotus feet of the noble sage. With flowers in great variety, the Buddha I adore, and by this merit may I gain release. Even as those flowers must fade, my body too will pass away. With lights brightly shining, dispelling the gloom, I honour the fully awakened light of the triple world, who dispels the gloom of ignorance. Perfumed with infinite qualities, the Tathagata, fragrant of face and form, I revere with incense sweet and penetrating. To the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, in the relics of his body, enshrined at Lanka, Jambudvipa, Nagaloka, and the heaven of the 33, in stupas there, I give honour. To all the images of the Buddha, in all 10 directions, to every hair and other relics, I give honour. To the 10 powers of the Buddha, to the cairn of Bodhi, I give honour. Honour to every stupa that may stand in place to relics, great Bodhi tree, and forms of Buddha everywhere.